Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries around the world over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the food crisis when we come back. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and they helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for their country. Well, today, over half the food that we eat in this country is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it's nutritionally deficient. Well, Adolf Steinbaum of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to the commercial feeds. And when they were compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbaum's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese. And the same result has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And in the opinion of many ecologic farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being in the first place. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for your free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about the food crisis. And Newsweek magazine put out three articles here recently dealing with this subject matter of On the Edge of Catastrophe is the title of one. La Nina threatens to hurt global 2008 wheat, corn, and soybean crops. Storm warning. And now it's the $6 loaf of bread. I pointed out earlier that a $6 loaf of bread here in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, it's gonna take a bite out of our discretionary income. It's going to affect the economy. But that's an inconvenience to us. You know, when I have to go to the gas station and I fill up my car, and the difference between, let's say, $2 a gallon and $3 a gallon, and I'm putting in 20 gallons of gas, it costs me an extra $20. And it's true. That's $20 that I won't have to spend on a new computer or on a new computer program, or I won't be able to go out and buy a new car or do something else to stimulate the economy. It's a drag on the economy. We here in the West, we're so spoiled and pampered that we're concerned about the luxuries of life. My God, I won't be able to afford escargot, or I won't be able to afford caviar. Why, I won't be able to buy that new big screen TV. But in most of the world, and that's the other 3.5 billion people in the world that you and I don't know anything about, we see their pictures on the TV reports from time to time with flies, you know, crawling around on little people's faces, you know, as they're laying there emaciated. Those people live on $2 a day, and in some cases they might make $4 or $5 a day. Hell, they might even make $10 a day. But we here in the West, and especially in the United States, you know, the median income here in the United States is $17.58 an hour. And you take $17.58 an hour times 2,000 hours in a year, and that's $35,160. $35,000 compared to $2 a day, which is less than $1,000. Now, picture this. Oftentimes people say, yeah, but those people have a lower standard of living. Boy, you can say that again. But the price of rice in India, where a guy's making $2 a day, is the same price that we're paying for rice here in the United States. And that's because of this new global economy, the world's global economy. You know, we here in the United States, we used to produce all of our food here, and we had a great abundance to export. That's no longer true. For the rest of you people in the world, America is right at the balance point of being a net food importer. Net food importer. The United States of America, called the breadbasket of the world. In years past, we used to marvel at the trainloads of grain that were going to our ports to be shipped off to India, 1968, that a monsoon failure over there. And there were 600 ships, plying the oceans between Texas and India to deliver that grain from the United States to stave off massive famine. We had it, and we shared it. We sold it. Now, because of the 545 policymakers in Washington, D.C., we have a new paradigm shift that has occurred in the production of grains, well, in the production of food in general. With the advent of huge airplanes like the 747, it's now possible here in the United States to have cherries in January. I mean, fresh cherries in January. They're pricey. I don't deny it. They're pricey. But Solomon, in all of his splendor and all of his glory, could not command at his age or at his time in history fresh cherries in January. Foods around the world are local. And at the agricultural level, when we deal with agriculture as opposed to agribusiness, we eat the foods that are in season. And in the northern climates, we have to prepare for the winter. We have to actually store up. When you're living in Germany and Poland and Russia and Canada and the United States, we have to store food from September, October, November, the harvest season, the fall, that's going to last us for the rest of the year. Now, we in the Western world are totally divorced from this concept. We are the age, we are the people who were raised watching television. We are raised watching Barney and Big Bird, and we are totally divorced from reality. Totally divorced. We don't have a clue. We go to the supermarket and there it is. It's a cornucopia of everything that you could desire. And we live in our cities and everything is brought to us and we expect it. And in the meantime, we have become totally incompetent, unable to feed ourselves. The people in New York City, Chicago, London, Berlin, those people cannot feed themselves any longer. But during World War II, it was a different story. Even in our big cities like Chicago, vacant lots were turned into gardens, community gardens, people's front and back yards. We didn't grow grass. We grow food in our yards. And surprisingly, and this is the big surprise, you can grow enough food on your lot to feed your family for a year. Did you know that? I know in most cases we think in terms of, oh, that's not enough ground. Well, it isn't enough ground if you're trying to grow wheat, corn, and soybeans, but it's more than enough ground if you're growing cabbages and broccoli and rutabaga and squash. I want to show you something here about squash. Most people don't like it. But squash is a filler like rice. It's a staple that the Indians in this country used to use. They would grow corn and squash, and then they would eat the squash like most of us here in the West eat potatoes, or you in the East eat rice to go along with a little meat and a little vegetables or something else. And squash just grow so prolifically. I mean, they're just like rain, you know, in a thunderstorm. It just can't put an end to squash. And you can keep those squash. You can live on those for a year. I mean, you know, they don't just rot, you know, overnight. And you can store that stuff up. And that's the stuff of which, you know, humanity for the last 5,000 years has been working or using. We grew our own food. We were independent. Today, we're totally dependent. And we're dependent upon multinational corporations like Cargill and ADM and others to provide all of that cornucopia of food delivered by those 747s from Chile to New York in January so that we can have things like strawberries and fresh cherries. This global economy, it's marvelous. I don't deny it. But it has within its sinews and fibers the seeds of our destruction. And that's because as long as everything is working well, you know, like the electric grid, as long as that thing is working fine, the elevators are going up and down fine, everything's great, traffic lights are working, shut the power off and disaster ensues. We've had that here in the United States 4 or 5 times now over the last 30 or 40 years. That's where the grid goes down. And then that's a disaster that's waiting to happen. We're not concerned too much about it because it hasn't happened. And there's good folks out there that are keeping the thing going. But we don't want to build any more power plants. And because we don't want to build any more power plants, or we certainly don't want a power plant in our backyard, we certainly don't want any nuclear power plants, or we certainly don't want any coal-fired power plants, and gas and oil are too expensive. And so we just don't build them. And so as time progresses along, we're going to wake up one day and we're going to have blackouts. And boy, that's going to be a nuisance if there ever was one. Well, we've done the same thing with food over the years. We made a paradigm shift after World War II, and we went from agriculture to agribusiness. I've reported on that. And the agribusiness model is much more efficient than the mom-and-pop farmer over here on the, you know, on the little plot of ground. Well, I don't deny that. One man with a tractor and some equipment can go out there when we reduce this to dollars, and he can produce so much more efficiently. It's kind of like the Chinese producing tennis shoes. The Chinese, working for less money, are much more efficient at producing tennis shoes and big-screen TVs than we Americans are, getting paid $20 an hour, or $17.58. And so we've exported those industries to China. And so now we've got the Chinese over there working, making our tennis shoes and making our big-screen TVs, while the rest of us are standing around unemployed over here wondering what the hell happened. So if you're talking about a business model, you're talking about efficiency, the agribusiness system is much more efficient. But it has a fatal flaw, and that is, over the years, between 1920, as I reported to you last time, and the present date, 2008, we've gone from 44 million farmers in the United States, that was about 44% of the people were engaged in agriculture. They fed themselves on the other 56%. Today, we have less than 1% of our population engaged in farming. And that 1% cannot feed 300 million people. So as the population is going up, the people producing food is going down. And America now is right at the break-even point of being a net importer of food, which is fine for us because we can afford to buy it. Well, we think we can, as long as our credit card has still got a couple of bucks on it. That's coming to an end here. But let me show you a story from Newsweek. It's called The $6 Loaf of Bread. In the afternoons, Ringo Pergonen, a 20-year-old who is training to be a cook, pedals his bicycle home through the densely populated Quezon City outside Manila. His mother usually leaves some bread and fruit juice for him to snack on before he returns to work. But today the kitchen is empty, save for a plastic container half filled with rice grains. His daily earnings of $4.70 a day and the wages from his mother's job washing dishes at a university canteen cannot buy enough food for his six-person family. With the price of rice having nearly tripled in recent months, the Pergonens usually skip breakfast, and it can be hard to accept things as they are, but we survive, he says. Now notice here, we don't know what his mother's making, but he's making $4.70 a day. There are six people in the family now. From the crowded Warrens of Manila to Walmart in Las Cruces, New Mexico, the price of food has become an unavoidable topic of conversation. In January, the bull run of agricultural commodities was an afterthought at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where the subprime crisis, sovereign wealth funds, and the seemingly inexorable rise of petroleum prices dominated the agenda. But in a few short months, food has replaced oil as the next big threat to the long-running global expansion. And in the past year, wheat and corn futures have risen 61% and 58% respectively. Rice futures have more than doubled since last August. And in the recent global boom, 5 years of growth that lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty forged new trading links and brought the hope of a better life to the developing world. The availability of plentiful, cheap food was generally taken for granted. But now much of the recent progress is being threatened by expensive food, whose advent has been a long time coming. And as with oil, the rising prices are fueled in part by speculators. And like oil, expensive staples are swiftly upsetting business plans, sparking inflation, causing political instability and inflicting widespread economic pain. The United Nations World Food Program says that hunger has reached a crisis level in all of the 121 poorest countries in the world, and has recently surveyed the high food prices are creating a silent tsunami threatening to purge and plunge more than 100 million people in every continent into hunger. The WFP, Executive Director of the United Nations, whose name is Josette Chiron in London, the tsunami is no longer so silent. Food-related protests have erupted in Cameroon and Egypt and Haiti, where the desperately hungry have turned to mud pies. That is, concoctions of cooking oil, bits of vegetables and dirt. Riots over food toppled the government in Haiti. The reasons behind the price spiral are at once complicated and simple. And although grain harvests in 2007 were the largest in the world's history, let me underline that, 2007, largest harvest of grains in the history of the world. Unfavorable weather, though, has caused crop failures in the Ukraine, which is a big producer of wheat, and wiped out Australia's once vast rice production. Now, I reported that here a couple of nights ago. Australia's rice production has gone from 100% to 2%. 98% of their production is gone. The Ukraine is suffering from drought and crop failure, and Australia is suffering from drought and crop failure. The United States, once a great exporter, in 2006, we were a net importer of grain. Net importer. Now, that's a vast turnaround. And if you've been around in America, you know, for the last 50 years, you know it should be shocking. Or as Brian Williams said the other night, unbelievable. Unbelievable that that would happen. Now, there's a couple other factors in here. I mentioned when we started tonight that a guy named Adolf Steinbaum of Fairbanks, Iowa, tested 4,000 samples of this hybrid corn. Let me tell you a little story here. I had a student come down here one time. He's a pig farmer up in Iowa. And he was telling me a story about some pigs that were dying. He said, big, healthy, fat pigs, and just everything going fine. All of a sudden, they just fall over dead. And I thought they had some new exotic disease in here, so they sent the carcasses off to the university, and they autopsied them, and they tested them and went through, and discovered they had a protein deficiency. Well, this protein deficiency, as it turns out, was a ConAgra blend of feed, corn, Iowa corn, that had 6% protein. And come to find out, pigs have to have 8% protein, nor they die from protein deficiency. Now, they look healthy. They look good, but they're nutritionally deficient, and so they'd fall over dead. So what they did was they raised the protein in the feed to 10%, and everything's fine. Now, I've reported on this before, so let me point it out again. Farmers are not paid for the protein content in their wheat, or in their corn, or in their soybeans. farmer gets paid for a bushel. He gets paid by weight. Now, some bright young kid, you know, from the Bronx, goes to college, gets a degree in chemical engineering. He needs a job, so he gets a job at Monsanto. So somebody at Monsanto says, well, you got to earn your keep, kid. So go invent something. So he comes up with his experimentation and says, oh, my God, we could hybridize seed. And by hybridizing the seed, we can get more tons of corn per acre. Now, this kid's a chemical engineer. He doesn't know anything about nutrition, doesn't know anything about agriculture, doesn't know anything about farming. He's a city kid, but he's a brilliant young man. And he goes out and he develops seed, hybrid seed, that produces 130 or 150 bushels to the acre. Now, what he doesn't know is that this 130 or 150 bushels to the acre only has 6% protein in it. After all, he's a chemical engineer. He's not a nutritionist. He's not being paid here to generate protein. He's being paid to generate a product over here, a seed that produces more bins and bushels. And he does that. And then Monsanto patents that. And then they go out to the farmers and they say, no, look, farmer, you know, this is an economy. And you're a farmer. You're a businessman. And you're getting 100 bushels to the acre. And we got a seed here that'll get you 150. It's a 50% increase. And the farmer says, well, I'd be a fool not to do this. And this is where we're at today. You see, the Green Revolution came along with hybrid seed. And today, now, we've got the new technology. It's called genetic modification. And each time we go through this step over here, we violate a fundamental law in the scripture. You know, just for you people out there that didn't know that there was a God. This God, this is an odd God. This isn't the ordinary, everyday, run-of-the-mill God that most of you people go to church and talk about. This God here, this creator, he gave us a statute in Leviticus 19:19 and told us not to hybridize that seed. Don't do that, he said. And, you know, business is business. And, you know, God is not is just not a good businessman. And because of that, he isn't tied into, doesn't understand stocks and bonds and speculation and wheat futures and one thing and another. And so we came along and we fixed God's mistake over here. And so instead of getting 100 bushels to the acre that has 16% protein, we now have 150 bushels to the acre that produces 6% protein. And then we wonder why it is that we can't afford health insurance. You see, when the health insurance thing got started after World War II, for example, I had a little problem one time. We didn't have any health insurance. Nobody did. I don't know of anybody that had health insurance in 1950. I'm sure that there was some out there, but I didn't know anybody that had it. We certainly didn't have it. And so in the marketplace, it cost $5 to go down and visit Dr. Walsh. It was an office call, $5. Now, $5 back in 1955, you know, was quite a bit of money. We were working for around $2, $2.50 an hour. So to go to the doctor, you know, you're talking about maybe 2-3 hours labor to pay for a doctor's call, doctor's visit. So when I had a problem come up, we would stall it off. And my dad would say, well, let's see if it goes away by itself. You know, if some kid had an earache or something, or, you know, his tonsils were swollen or something, well, just leave it alone. It'll go away. Sure enough, it does. You know, it goes away. But when you've got insurance, you see, and you've got an earache or something like that, why the young mother, you know, she grabs her kid, runs off to the pediatrician. What the hell do we care if it costs $75 today for an office call? It's irrelevant. The insurance company's going to pay for that. No, they're not. Insurance companies don't pay for any of that. Not a dime. The policy, rate payers, they pay all of it, 100%, 100 cents on the dollar, plus a profit to the insurance company. So they just raise the rates of the insurance until now it's so high because you people abused it so often that you now can't afford it. Well, the reason that you've got these earaches and these tonsils swollen, one thing and another, is because of the poor nutrition that's coming out of the food that you're eating. Now, we've got lots of it, no doubt about that. I mean, we've got so much of it that we can make gasoline out of it now. You know, we're making ethanol. And that's fine. It's a business decision that we have to make, and we're making that business decision. But in the meantime, we're taking about 6% of our corn crop, and we're turning that into fuel instead of feeding people. And now that grain that was once available for export, you see, is now being consumed here in the United States. So we're no longer a net exporter. In some cases, we're net importers. And in the years ahead, it's going to become more and more like that. We're going to put up more and more biofuels operations. And here's why. You see, corn now is higher priced, isn't it? So now farmers are getting paid more money for corn. And so they're going to plant more corn to go into more ethanol to put into your gas tank. So there's going to be less and less food available. We're going to produce more and more grain, and we're going to produce less and less food. And that's the economic model. That's the agribusiness model. And it's guaranteed to bring on world famine. The agribusiness model is designed to bring on world famine. It's not necessarily the intent, but it's the net results of that model. Now, the agriculture model is a little different. The agriculture model is based upon production at the local level. See, my granddad, when he came home from work in World War II, he would go work in the garden. every night for 2 or 3 hours. You know, we'd come home and we'd eat, and then right after we'd eat, we'd go outside, and all the neighbors were doing that. Across the fence would be Mrs. Swain, and across the other fence would be Mrs. Johnson. And then down a couple of three doors would be Mrs. Birchfield, and old man Johnson, old man Birchfield. You know, they all worked in the mill, and when they came home, the wives and kids and everybody's out weeding in the garden and picking, and the women were canning and one thing and another. We produced in our yard. We produced just about all the food that we ate. Now, we bought some things. We had ration cards, you know. We didn't have cows. We didn't have goats, but we had chicken. And other people had rabbits, and people had chickens and rabbits, and they produced their own meat. You know, then they take their ration cards and go down and get a steak or a piece of beef or some hamburger or something, you know, because that was ration. Sugar, you couldn't get sugar. It was ration. And so we had to be frugal with our sugar and frugal with our beef, but we had plenty of meat. We had plenty of chicken. We had chicken, you know, 3 or 4 times a week, and people would eat rabbits. You know, we at that time I eat rabbits. Yeah, that's right. People were geared to production. Now it's more efficient to have a tractor out there in dollars and cents. But if you want total production, I mean, if you're looking for how do we produce more rutabagas, you give that to the little guy on a little patch of ground. Because if you've got 2,000, 3,000 square feet of ground, I mean, you can feed this guy here that we're talking about. He's got 6 people in his family. Now, notice what he's doing. He is going to school to learn how to be a cook. And he's getting $4.70 in the day. This is the industrial model. Don't produce any food, sir, for your mother and your 6 people in your family. Don't you produce any food. You let some farmer out here who's more efficient than you produce the food, and you go out and work and make money and go in and buy the food. Now, by doing that, we have more and more people and fewer farmers every year, which now raises the price of food because we're producing less and less of it, less and less per person, more and more of it. Biggest grain harvest in history in 2007. But because of some crop failures in a couple of countries and because we're adding 70 or 80 million people every year to the population, we have actually less food per person. All right, now, the food that we're getting per person has fewer and fewer nutrients in it, which then causes poorer and poorer health and more doctors and more diseases, and it costs more and more for health insurance. Let me give you a reminder here, and we'll come back and we'll take a look at what did we do in World War II to solve that problem. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective in 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can all be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. And they do not necessarily represent the beliefs, the views, and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Okay, we're talking about the food crisis. The industrial model is very efficient. It produces more dollars of profit per unit of effort than does my granddad coming home after work and picking up a shovel and spading up the ground. But my granddad produced more food per square foot than any farmer in America can produce today, because he only had 2,000 or 3,000 square feet to work with, and so he was busily composting and putting all the table scraps, you know, and leaves and grass and anything that he could down into the ground to increase the organic material in the ground. Farmers today haven't got time for that. They're not interested in organic material and organic farming. They're interested in chemicals. And they buy chemicals by the truckload, and they spread it on the ground, and it kills the microorganisms in the soil. It actually depletes soil nutrition, the absorption rate of the plants absorbing the minerals from the soil. They grow big, beautiful plants with chemicals. Oh, they're God, they're gorgeous. And then they come through and they spray the fields with chemicals, you know, to kill all the weeds and kill all the insects. That's so that we don't have any blemishes on our apples and on our corn, one thing or another. But that corn that we're eating there is nutritionally deficient. That's what our problem is, even if you got enough of it and your belly is full. You got to keep eating more and more of it because it doesn't have the minerals to shut off your hunger pangs. So you eat more and more of this food and we get fatter and fatter. Can't figure out why we're obese and why we're sick. Well, it's the bad food that we're eating. This chemical food is bad. Now, I talked to you about this thing of hoarding last time. Remember we were talking about hoarding? And I said, no, nobody is complaining about Bill Gates hoarding money or Warren Buffett. But if I've got 200 cans of coffee, I'm a hoarder. Let me ask you this. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that I take a couple of cows. Now, normal farmers, what they do is they take their cows and sell them. And then they take the money and go down to Safeway and buy their food. Now, let's suppose that I work this a little bit differently. And I take my cows. I took two bulls the other day, and I sent them over to the butcher. He called me back, and he said that I've got, there was 601 and 7, 1,300 pounds of meat. Now, 1,300 pounds of beef is a lot of beef, ain't it? Now, let's suppose I take my 1,300 pounds of beef, and I can all of that. You know how much I'm going to end up with, 1,300 pounds, 2 pounds to a jar? I'm going to end up with 650 quarts of meat with 2 pounds in each jar. Would you say that I was a hoarder? Think about that. See, most of you people out there, you don't put up 600 cans or 600 jars of meat. You go to the store 3 times a week and you buy 2 pounds of meat each time you go to the store. I watch people do this. They burn up more energy, burning up gasoline, going back and forth to the store than they're hauling in calories out of the store and taking home, putting on the table. Did you know that? I reported this the other day. Here in America, every calorie that we eat off of the table took 10 calories of input. It's really inefficient. To make a profit, my granddad, when he went out into the garden and he expended his energy, he was putting a calorie on the table, but he only expended a half a calorie to produce it. It was a net profit. Agriculture is profitable, and agribusiness is not profitable. Well, it's not profitable from energy input to energy output, input-output. And that's where you're at with these biofuels. I mean, you know, you can turn out gasoline, you know, from corn. We don't deny that. But it takes more energy to produce it than you're getting out of it. Now, that's why petroleum has been such a big boon. See, all of that oil buried in the ground, we can pull it out of the ground. And it only takes 17% of the energy to get it out of the ground that we receive from it, or the BTUs from the energy that we're using, the oil that we're using. It's an 83% return. It's an 83% profit. So you expend 17 barrels of oil to pump the oil out of the ground, and you net 83 barrels that you can use driving your car, making chemical fertilizers or something else. So it's very profitable. It's very good. But it's a finite resource that is running out. And so whether this peak oil is politically derived or it's physically derived is irrelevant. We have reached peak oil, whether the Saudis just won't pump anymore or whatever it is. Now, we haven't reached physical peak oil, but we certainly have reached political peak oil. Now, I don't know how many people can be supported on planet Earth if we had the agricultural model like my granddad on 2,000 or 3,000 square feet. And here's where the beauty of this comes in. If this young man over in the Philippines, well, I don't know where he lives, but I'm assuming he's got a house. I'm assuming he's got 2,000 or 3,000 square feet of ground. Most people do. I mean, just looking around my neighborhood here, everybody here has 2,000 or 3,000 square feet of ground. There isn't anybody in my neighborhood. I don't know of anybody in Ozark County, Missouri. That there are a few. There's a few apartment dwellers, but there isn't anybody that I know of that doesn't have a yard. Most of them just grow grass or ornamental shrubs. I mean, they're not growing cherry trees. I don't understand for the life of me why it is that out in the front yard, you've got this ornamental tree. And you went to the nursery and you spent a lot of money buying it. And you came home, dug a hole, and you planted it, and you water it, and you grow it, and it looks beautiful. Wouldn't it be more logical to plant a couple of cherry trees instead of these ornamental trees? And, you know, cherry trees, I think, look pretty good, and they produce cherries, and you can eat the cherries. What are you eating off this ornamental tree? Nothing. And this is where the production comes in. It's not the hoarding that's important. It's the production. You see, the difference is, not only have I got 1,300 pounds of meat from these two bulls, but I've got the facilities here to produce more bulls. See, I've got two more steers coming up right after these two, and then I've got calves that are being born this year, and 2 years from now, over and over, this agricultural cycle that I'm involved in over here will constantly keep me fed. I not only have two bulls to sell this year, or two bulls to eat this year, I'm going to have two for next year, and two the year after, and two the year after that, and after that, and after that. Now look at my family. I've got 6 mouths to feed, and I've got 1,300 pounds of meat to feed them with. Now you're going to sit there and say, well, yeah, but I live in the city and I don't have. I told you yesterday. You can go to the sale barn, for crying out loud, and buy one of these cutter and canners for under $1,000. You people are spending $10,000 a year in the supermarket and complaining about the price of beef. You can go to the auction barn, for crying out loud, and buy one. Pay somebody to haul it off to the butcher. Pay the butcher to butcher it for you. Now take the meat home and can it, and you can have 600 cans of meat on your shelf. And instead of standing in line and sharing the shortage, you'll have this abundance. And that's what production is. And that's what agriculture is all about. And that's what the Ten Commandments are all about. It's a business model. It's an agricultural model. The Ten Commandments is a model for politics, society, family, education, agriculture, business, economics, religion, money, and law. And the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto is a process. It's a model. It's a forum for politics, society, family, education, agriculture, business, economics, religion, money, and law. The difference between these two models is that one produces abundance and the other produces shortage. And I got to tell you that the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto look real good. Like any con, like any fraud, it really looks good. In fact, God made this observation twice in the scripture. He said, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. The agricultural model that we adopted after World War II, the agribusiness model, God, it looks good. We can move to the city and work for the Ford Motor Company and get $5 a day. Then we can take the profit off of our labor and go down to the store and buy food. In 1920, it was a hell of an idea. Really looked good. And that's what we did. We had 44 million people on the farms, producing food and fiber for themselves and feeding the other 56% living in the cities. Now, to get a higher, cheaper labor pool, Henry Ford offered $5 a day. The people left the farms. By 1940, the population on land had dropped to 32 million. In 20 years, it dropped from 44 million to 32 million. No problem yet. We still have 32 million farmers out here, little farmers producing for us. Now, the proportions are going down. The population is getting bigger and bigger, and the number of farmers feeding them is less and less. All right, by 1969, here comes another 20 years. The population on the land drops to 6%. 6%. And the population is still growing. More and more mouths to feed, less and less farmers. We're still not doing too bad. 6% of us farming could feed the other 170 million. And then the worm turned. Today, we're down to less than 1%, and we can no longer feed our own population here in the United States. And that's what's happened in the Philippines, and that's what's happened in, it's in the process of happening in China. Hadn't happened there yet, but it's in the process. The agribusiness model sounds real good, and it's very efficient. One man can produce a hell of a lot more food. My granddad, you know, he could produce a lot of food per square foot, but he couldn't produce enough food to feed 20, 30, or 50 other people, but he could feed his own family. And this guy in the Philippines making $4.70 a day. If he would stop working for $4.70 a day, and if he spent his time just working in his own garden, he could feed the whole family of six all by himself. In fact, he probably could continue working for $4.70 a day. And if all of the members of the family would go out and work in the garden, feed themselves, they could provide all of their own food. And then when the price of rice triples, quadruples, sextuples, what does he care? I'm sitting over here, boys and girls, and I'm paying the same prices for rice that you are, and I'm sitting here saying, I really don't care if the price of rice doubles, triples, quadruples, sextuples. It's irrelevant to me. Because I can produce my own food. Now, I don't produce rice. I don't produce wheat, and I don't produce soybeans. But then I don't eat much of that either. And what little bit of wheat we do eat, we buy. See, I sell that meat, and then I buy the wheat. But I'm a net producer. I have more food than I can eat. I don't know what to do with all the food that I produce here. And I don't see why everybody else in the world doesn't do the same thing that I'm doing. I don't have some secret process going on over here. I'm not a Bill Gates. I'm not making billions of dollars a year. I don't need to. But Bill Gates, when you get down on the bottom line, I read you this story the other day. Let me read it to you again. It's in 2 Kings chapter 6. It's a hell of a story. In 2 Kings chapter 6, there's this woman, and there's a famine going on here. And she goes out and she buys. This is in 2 Kings chapter 6, starts in verse 24 through verse 29. There's five verses here. There was a great famine in Samaria. And behold, they besieged the city until an ass's head was sold for 40 pieces of silver. Now, that's 80 pieces of silver and the fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. Now, let's take a look and think about that for a minute, because I got to tell you a little story here about World War II. There was a fellow by the name of Nick Mingelin. Nick Mingelin. And he, in 1940, he's 12 years old. And when the Germans attacked Holland in 1940, his family living in Amsterdam rushed Nick out to the uncle's farm, which was 40 kilometers from Amsterdam, out in the countryside here, close to the city, but out here 20 miles out of town. And Nick reported, after the war, he came here to the United States and as a young man. And so he reported to me that while he lived on the farm, that his uncle was a farmer, and they had cabbages and rutabagas, and they had cows and plenty of milk. They had all the food that he could eat during World War II. The people in the city were on ration carts, just like this guy in Quezon City in the Philippines. And they all depended upon the farmers producing the food and bringing the food into the city for the people in the city to live. And He said that after the Allies attacked in September of 1944, he said all the people in the city are now unemployed. You see, these people working in the cities are now building, are working for the war machine, the German war machine. They're engaged in agriculture out in the countryside, but they're engaged in industrial pursuits inside the city. And they're buying their food, just like this young fellow here in the Philippines. He's working, and he's taking his money and buying food. Now watch what happens. The Allies come through, and the Germans put up a hell of a tussle. And they tore up the fields, and they just raised hell. You know, there's fighting back and forth over this piece of real estate. So pretty soon the fight's over, and the people in the city are all unemployed now because they were working in the factories, you know, producing, for the Germans, for the economy. And now all of a sudden the Americans come in, and now the German money is of no value. And the Americans don't have any economy to replace it with. There's no jobs, as George Bush, you know, is telling us. And so these people now, they're unemployed. They got no money. And there's no food. I mean, their ration cards are of no value. There's no money in the land. So Nick reported that these people are taking grandfather's clocks and tapestries and diamond rings and gold watches and all kinds of jewelry and gold coins, whatever they could get, whatever had value. They'd come out to the farms and try to negotiate deals with the farmers. And Nick's uncle took lots of diamond rings and gold watches and grandfather's clocks, and he put them up in his barn and filled all of his buildings, and he's got all this stuff, you know, until about May of 1945. And then one day the uncle said, no, I will not take your diamond ring for a cabbage. No, I will not take your gold watch for a rutabaga. What I need is gasoline, tires, batteries. There's some things that I need, and I don't need any more gold watches. Now, there's a philosophy going on here in America. We think that gold is going to solve our problems. I talk to people quite often. I think gold's good stuff. I'm not opposed to gold and silver. I recommend it highly. But I tell my students, you know, I think that food is going to be more valuable than gold, based upon what I heard from World War II and Nick Mingland. Based upon what I see here in the Bible, here's 80 pieces of silver. I showed you this the other day. 80 pieces of silver, boys and girls, if it was 80 ounces, you know, times 16 bucks. Let's just try that. 80 times 16, $16. This is what silver is selling for. That's $1,280 for a donkey head, for crying out loud. There isn't 5 pounds of meat on a donkey head. You're not going to get 50% meat off of a donkey head. And it's an unclean animal to boot. Now, when you get down to where you're paying 80 pieces of silver, now, that's pretty expensive meat. I think the means of production, I think raised beds in your backyard, I think a little flock of chickens in your backyard, I think a rabbit hutch back there is going to make more sense than a job in the city. And your job is being exported to India. And one of these days you're going to be unemployed, standing in line with your hand out. Why don't you take control and get control of the production in your own backyard? I mean, if you got 2,000 square feet, if you don't have 2,000 square feet, have you ever thought about going over to somebody that's got it and renting it from him? Have you thought about a vacant lot in the city? I mean, I drive around the city, there's vacant lots everywhere. I mean, you people have parks all over. Now, during World War II, people were using vacant lots. Sure, you just go to the owner of the vacant lot and you say, hey, listen, partner, I'd like to plant rutabagas in there. I'd like to plant some carrots and spinach and one thing and another. How much, you know, do I have to pay you for it? We used to call that sharecropping. Now, I got to tell you that it's demeaning. Oh, yeah, work is demeaning. We didn't know that when I was a kid. I think you'll find out how demeaning work is when you're hungry. And that's coming. And the reason I tell you that's coming is because of Revelation chapter 6. Remember, I showed you this the other day. You take 6 billion people, and you take 25% of that 6 billion people. How many people are going to die? It says here 25%, the fourth part of men. Let's just read it for you. This is in Revelation chapter 6, called the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I mean, you people can sit there and laugh and hoot and holler if you want, but you know, sometimes people call the law and go, where are you getting these numbers? You know, where are you getting your information? Well, I just got it right here. A guy by the name of John wrote it down about 2,000 years ago. Said he got it directly from God. So I just thought I'd report it to you. He starts off here with false prophets, chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. And then we got war in verses 3 and 4. Here's the famine in verse 5. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, come and see. And I beheld, and lo, a black horse, and he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, a measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny, and see that you hurt not the well in the wine. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was death, and hell followed after him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. What I don't know here is this one-fourth of a declining balance four times? Or is it one-fourth in just this one plague? If that's the case, then we're going to witness 100 there would be 1.5, be 1,500 million or 1.5 billion people die. That's one out of four. However, if it's 25% from each one of the four horses, then you start with 6 billion. It declines by 25% to 4.5 billion, which declines by 25% to 3.37 billion, which declines by, you know, another 25% of 2.5 billion. So you end up with a 1.8 billion in the final analysis, which is getting down toward that 10% that the Club of Rome and the Global 2000 advocates are pushing today, which just kind of fits in with that 10% that God said that he was going to save alive for seed on the earth in Isaiah chapter 6, verse 13. So as a reporter, if you want to know, well, where do you get your information? Well, I start off here with the scripture. Then I get my news reports from Newsweek magazine. Then I go to kitco.com. And then I take a look at the historical business model of agribusiness and agriculture. And I put the story together and I present it. And the story that I'm presenting says to me that we got some big problems coming up here. Big problems. Now, we have two schools here that we teach. One is called Subsistence and Survival. The other is how to make $100,000 on 25 acres or less. Those will be in September. And if you go to our website in August and September, we'll be having a couple of these schools here. And it'll give you the dates, or you can call us here at the law school, and we'll give you the dates for it. I say that production, your ability to produce your own food and fiber in your own backyard, is a hell of a lot more valuable to you than having a pile of gold like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. That's my take on it. I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.